Hello, and welcome to Sobercast, where we provide AA speaker meetings and workshops in podcast format. We're an ad-free podcast, and if you enjoy listening, please help us be self-supporting by visiting Sobercast.com, look for the donate link, and drop a dollar or two into our virtual basket. We hope you enjoy the podcast. Have a great day.
My name is Wendy, and I'm an alcoholic. It's good to be here, and it's good to be sober. I want to thank Larry for asking me to come out and participate in my sobriety. Hi, Larry. I really do want to remember that it's really a privilege to be out in the world, upright, not covered in puke, with clean underwear on, and free to move about. It's always, I'm a hopeless, helpless, hope-to-die alcoholic who, in my state of being that is unmarred by recovery, I am 4 or 5 days at a time locked in a room, covered in urine and vomit, wearing the same clothes, not moving off the couch, drinking 2-3 cases of beer a day. And that's how I roll. So, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. If you're new here tonight, I got to say that this is truly, I have found the thing that I was always looking for in Alcoholics Anonymous, only I didn't know what I was looking for. I just knew for a very long time that I wasn't right. And I am absolutely, completely, and wholly in love with Alcoholics Anonymous today. I want to thank my friends for driving out with me. My friend Lorena drove all the way down with me from Orange County, and I'm so happy she's here. And my friend Lisa met us, and I'm going to totally out her. Lisa just recently moved here from South Orange County, and she is an AA in the process of relocation. And she said to me at dinner tonight that she's going to make this one of her home groups, so please all come and join her. Get her phone number. It's a serious thing. Relocation AA is it's serious. It's harder, I think, than it is being new, coming to a new place, getting doing all the stuff you did when you were a newcomer, shaking hands, going, saying yes to all that stuff, going to the potlucks with, you know, a dish you're not sure anybody's going to like. And no, true story. One time, I was about 6 months sober, and you know how it is when you first get your first commitments in Alcoholics Anonymous, and you are going to do it better than anyone has ever done it? I got this recipe for, it was butternut cannoli squash, like it was a, it was a butternut squash cannoli, and it was like with mushroom sauce, and it was like a Martha Stewart recipe. And so in my mind, I was going to do everything fresh because I was like, I'm a foodie, don't you know it? And I've never had, did you have like the beliefs about yourself when you were drinking? Like, I am everything in a bag of chips. But you just never actually tried to put it into action, you know what I mean? Like, you knew you were capable of it, but you never actually tried it. And so I knew I really was a chef. And now I'm newly sober, and I get to actually implement the ideas I was having while I'm sitting on a bar stool. You know what I mean? And so, I mean, I spent like, have you ever tried to mash up and cut a butternut squash? They're hard. Who knew? Like, you've got to cook those for hours before they get soft enough to, so I didn't do that enough. Like, literally, and I'm practically with like a chip and hammer trying to peel this thing apart for hours. And I finally got it to the point where I could, it was a presentable recipe. You know, it eventually gets to like a mush, you know, and it's a delicious cream-filled mush that goes inside of the cannoli that you top with the cheese and the mushroom sauce and the whole big thing. And it ends up, it's like a casserole, you know. But it's hours of work if you do it from scratch, like hours. Like, and then like I come to find later that in the grocery store you can buy pre-cubed butternut squash. So I learned the hard way the first time, and I remember walking into this potluck and like you know, there's so many other people there, and they're all bringing in, like, they're the smart ones. They went to the grocery store, they picked up a rotisserie chicken, and they show up. And I'm just, like, walking in. I was, like, 6 months sober. The woman grabbed the dish, grabbed it, put it at the end, and she's like, okay, why don't you go out and enjoy? And I was like, no, what? Like, in my head, I'm expecting just fanfare and accolades from my I don't think anyone even knew, you know, they even paid attention. And I wish I could say that was the only time I've done that. I mean, I've done that over and over and over again in Alcoholics Anonymous. I was the cake chick at a birthday meeting. And I didn't just bring, like, go to the grocery store and get the cake. Like, it had to be. Like, I went and pre-ordered a big book cake, a cake that was made in the shape of a big book. Like, I was coming in. And I didn't realize, this old-timer came up and tapped me on the shoulder, and he was like, look, it's not about you and giving you attention. It's just a cake. You need to come in with a normal cake kind of a thing. And I was like, I didn't even realize I was doing that. You know, I didn't know I was trying to make it about me. I didn't know I was trying to stand out. I don't know how self-centered I am. You know, it's taken, and I'm grateful that they've cared more about my life than my feelings. I really am. Although they could back off a little bit sometimes, you know what I mean? But I don't know. I am in love with Alcoholics Anonymous. I've drank the Kool-Aid. I'm fully and completely surrendered to this thing. I have done the work enough to know that the results are real, that this thing does work, that how I feel in my skin today on most days is nothing the way I felt like I felt before. I have a solution that has come from working the 12 steps and practicing the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I do believe it's a practice. But I'm in love with funny things in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm in love with the humor. I'm in love with just the day-to-day crazy that happens here. Like, it's just where the joy of life is for me. Like, I mean, seriously, this business meeting, for this meeting right here, I mean, it seems like a lovely, very strong meeting. But this business meeting, where they decide to spend the money on a rather expensive banner for Southern California speakers in Alcoholics Anonymous, yet we have a music stand for a podium. There was a steering committee. Somewhere down the line, there was a group, there was like some alcoholic minds that work in a committee deciding on this right here. I'm not complaining, you know. I'm just observing and reporting. One more story and I'm going to get to my job. My job here from the podium is to share with you what it was like, what happened, what it's like now, newcomer. I'm just supposed to tell you what it is I've done a day at a time to stay sober. I can't, if you're like me, you can't listen to anyone tell you what to do. And really, that would be a lie because I don't know what to do. I can just tell you what I've done. That since August 10th, 2003, and I am another Wendy coming up on 14 years. Congratulations, Wendy's and other birthday people. It was Stuart and Jorge. So what did anybody else wonder this? What was the bad news? Like, you were all, this is the good news. I love that about us. Nobody ever tells you the bad news here. I've never gotten over the gossip part of that. It's like never, not yet. It could happen. So I was about, I'm going to say, 9 months sober, and I'm going to this incredibly raunchy, like, the women are women and the sheep are scared kind of meeting in Rancho Cucamonga. And just a really rough women's meeting, rowdy. Barely any rules or structure followed. Shoes and shirts were optional kind of thing. And I loved it because it was so irreverent. And I love the structure. And I love what Alcoholics Anonymous has given me. But there's a part of me that I just need to be a little bit bad, that loves those meetings that are a little bit loud, that they kind of chant during the, you know, chapter 5 readings. And I've always loved that a little bit. And so they invited me to this birthday party, and it was a woman's 10-year birthday party. And for the birthday party, they were going to be playing this game called I Love My Neighbor. Has anybody ever played this game, Love Thy Neighbor? So essentially it works like this. It's kind of like a musical chairs, truth or dare, recovery deal. So you have a group of women, and these are all sober women. You know, we're talking, for me, they were giants, 4 years and up, you know. And they were like maybe 30 women in that group, married, kids, there was lots of kids in the background. And all of us put the chairs in a big circle, and it's like musical chairs, in that whoever is left without a chair has to go to the center of the circle and participate in the game, and then they keep removing chairs, kind of a thing. Well, so the game is like this. It's sort of a weird kind of fifth step. It's sort of in the disclosing of what's going on in that room, you realize that you are not alone. And you get up in the front of the room and you say, "I love my neighbor because my neighbor stole a pack of cigarettes," right? And if anyone else has stolen a pack of cigarettes, they have to stand up and circulate and fight for the next chair. They don't find a chair, they go to the center of the room, kind of a thing. Well, so the idea is, the goal is, to be the person who's done something nobody else does. And alcoholics are like a little bit competitive. And like, so it goes down and dirty fast. Like, you start off and you're like, "Oh, I love my neighbor because my neighbor stole a pack of markers from the CVS store," or something like that. And then, you know, everyone stands up and everyone plays the game, you know, kind of thing. So I don't know, I'm like four or five in, can't find a chair. And I mean, I'm really kind of at the beginning of the game, and I'm convinced, like, these women have never seen the likes of me, right? And I get up and I say my absolute worst thing, and everyone, like, there was not one woman that, you know, "I love my neighbor because my neighbor went to her lover's wife's house and introduced herself." True story. Everyone in the room stood up. Everyone. And this is like 30 women, and I'm like, whoa, right? I'm like 9 months, I'm just like, really? Like, it's like, no, you know? I can't believe they're as bad as me, kind of a thing. And I go and I sit back down, and we like, and then this girl, Jamie, gets up. And, you know, I am out by this point. I'm so out of the game. And Jamie gets up and she says, "I love my neighbor because every time my neighbor has sex with her husband, she fantasizes about Christy." And everyone points to Christy. Like 10 women stood up and went circles. And I'm like, no. And I was like, "I want everything you have. Like, you are my people, you know?" And it's just been like that for me across the board. Like, I can't even express to you. It may sound, I've never been so home. I've never been so home as when I'm in a room of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I know that anywhere I go, I have no problem standing here in a room full of strangers that I've never met sharing the story, because I know you've done it. Newcomers, my job from this podium is to share with you what it was like, what happened, what it's like now. I'm going to share with you right now that my sobriety date is August 10, 2003. God willing, be willing. If I make it to Thursday, I'll be 14 years sober. So, my sponsor is Teresa F. in the Valley, and my home group is the Do It Sober group of Alcoholics Anonymous that meets daily in Laguna Woods at 7:30 a.m. And, I was confused when I first got here, and you told me that an alcoholic takes a drink and the drink takes a drink. You told me that I suffered from a spiritual malady that manifests itself in an allergy of the body and an obsession of the mind. You told me that I can never safely drink again. You also told me that I didn't have to live that way anymore if I didn't want to. And I'm looking back over my life, over my drinking, and it doesn't start that way. You know, I'm 5 years old. I'm in rural Pennsylvania. I come from a completely normal, uninteresting, slightly below middle income, Wonder Bread, soggy white family that's just not very remarkable. There's nothing standout-ish about my family. You know, we had a cornfield across the street. We had, we were on the border of like a suburban community. We lived in a sort of shabby three-bedroom, two-bath house. Most of the house was kind of like hand-me-down, giveaway furniture, with the exception of the living room. The living room had a nice couch and a nice chair, and it was the entertaining area for my mom, and it was the keep-up-with-the-Joneses room, and there was a little tiny silver tray. The silver tray was like a table, but it wasn't really silver. It was like a plastic-covered chrome, but it looked silver. And it had like a silver rope that was sort of the rim of the table, and there was three decanters that were all sort of crystalline, you know, and you could see the liquid inside with the stoppers, and there was crystal all over it, kind of a thing, and liquids inside that just danced in the light with the crystal, kind of a thing, and there were rocks glasses of that same crystally, it wasn't really glass material, like a plastic, upside down, and like a chrome, again, plastic, ice container for an ice bucket with tongs like next to it, and this whole display in the living room. And it's like the only piece of furniture I remember in the entire house. So, but when I look back, my dad would take me hunting, and I'm 5-6 years old. I know, 5-6 years old, out alone with my dad hunting, and he'd give me sips of his beer. It was a different time. So, but I don't remember taking a sip and, like, you know, finding myself in the gutter the next day in a brown paper bag. So I'm, like, looking back over my life, examining my relationship to alcohol. I did not take a drink, and then the drink took a drink. And so for a long time in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, I'm kind of like, is this me? Did I just go through a bad spell? You heard me say that I was drinking 2 to 3 cases of beer a day, covered in puke 4 or 5 days. It's a little bit more than a bad spell at that point. I don't know. I've crossed the line from cucumber to pickle, but I have to, you know, I'm around here till my brain thaws a little bit enough to figure it out. And 8 years old, my parents get divorced, and I absolutely did not get to live with a parent of my choice. And the reality was that my mother went on to dental school. The fact of it was that she wanted so much to provide a really good, responsible, good role model for her daughters, but the feeling was that my mother just threw me away. And I did nothing but act out, living with a perfectly loving, incredibly committed, phenomenal father, but I just did nothing but act out. I hung out with the wrong kids, I ran away, I cussed, I did whatever I have to do to get away from the guy. And he eventually relented. At about 12 years old, I got to go live with my mom, and she's just starting out as a dentist, and, you know, we're still living in a one-bedroom apartment, and I started at this kind of high-end junior high school, and at this point, I'm 250 pounds, and I'm 12 years old, and I have a huge afro of hair, and I felt like a monster. I felt like this Amazon woman. I looked at all the kids in the class, and I thought, there's all these pretty, blonde, waify little girls, and they're not me. Like, I felt like all the promises that there were for any little girl for their future of being married, graduating college, having loving families, going on to have friendships, all of those promises you hear about in the future, they were there for them, but they weren't there for me. And I knew it. Like, I just felt like a stepchild from the beginning. They had a little uniform for gym class at this school. It was like those dolphin shorts they made girls wear in the 80s, which are just, that was wrong. It was like this little flimsy material, and they were really short. And they sent me to go buy them, and I remember when I went and bought them, they didn't even carry them in my size. And the shame of that, the feeling that I don't belong, was more than I could even verbalize. And so I just went home. I ditched class. I went, you know, I found myself 2 in the afternoon or something like that, going back home, went straight to the kitchen. There's one little cabinet that my mom had of, like, some liquors that she would have used to entertain. There's nobody with me, so it's not social drinking. And I have no idea who taught me to do that. I'm just grabbing the top inch of every strange liquor she has there, because she really does enjoy putting together a fancy cocktail. But I'm like, I'm not drinking it for cocktail. I'm drinking it for effect. And I'm taking the top inch off things like framboise, jambouille, triple sec, like whatever, Midori, like whatever in the cabinet, and filling it back up with water, dumping it all into the same glass and downing it. And I remember passing out, and I remember a neighbor finding me, and I might have puked. It didn't matter. You know, it just didn't matter. I got what I wanted. Alcoholics Anonymous, you taught me to share my experience, strength, and hope, although I think I already knew that, which is I went to the corner parking lot. I found the kids that looked like they did what I did, and I shared my experience, strength, and hope with them. And they called my bluff, and they upped the ante, and they invited me to go do some other things. And I didn't want to do other things at all, but I did want to have friends. So I went. And, I mean, all I ever really wanted was to be a good girl. That's all I wanted to be. I wanted to be like those pretty girls on the cover of Seventeen magazine that had shoes that matched their blush purse, that matched their blush lipstick. That's all I wanted to be. I walked around and I felt like I was a monster I wasn't a part of. I heard a speaker just say it. I felt intermittently doomed to always have to work three times as hard to get half of what you had. And I just felt so different from. And because I felt so different from, and like God's throwaway, and like the promises were there for you, they weren't for me. I knew I was different. Therefore, the rules don't apply to me. I don't have to play your game. I'm going to tell you what it is you need to know. I'm going to tell you what I think you need me to say, but none of it's going to be real. And then I'm going to go do what the hell I want. And so in high school, I'm drinking on the weekends. I'm trying to show up. I'm trying to pull it together to be the good girl, and, you know, in the academic world and not let the two groups of friends mix. I'm finding really hard to drink during the week to feel comfortable. And so I'm, you know, going to my mom's dental office, and I've had an extra set of keys made to her car so I can get myself to my mom's dental office, where I have an extra set of keys made for her office, where I have my own personal pharmacy of Vicodin, Valium, Xanax, and a Costco side jars. Bringing him back to my house, and that's just to kind of, you know, make it through the week. And, you know, in AA, they taught me that I have a spiritual malady, that there is a quench, there is a thirst, there is a yearning for a connection with God. And it all sounds very lofty and all very religious, but what I've really come to experience here is that I sought my soul, and it evaded me. I sought my God. How's it go? I sought my soul, and it evaded me. I sought my God, and I could not see. I found my brother, and I found all three. Something like that. It's like they tell you in the big book that wherever two or three are gathered, there he is in the midst. The closer I am to you, the closer I am to him, because he's there. Like, I've got to be with you. And all of my life, all I'm doing is trying to pull one over on you. You're an actor in my play. You're two-dimensional. You're somebody I either need to avoid. You're someone I need to get something from, or you're someone I need to look like I'm friends with. You know, I need to kind of like, you are not someone I consider another human being whose feelings I have to concern myself with. I don't even have to think of you as human. You are there for me only. And so my God-sized hole, as you will, although I think that's a weird way of expressing it, my inability to connect with people is... it leaves me with a thirst that I can't even identify as a thirst. And I am constantly reaching for things on the outside. In a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, I can tell you with everything in me out of dying reverence for this place, I will always identify as an alcoholic, because in here it's our common solution. We are all here in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous because we're seeking solution over alcohol. However, I will say with my story, as you're about to hear, that there are probably 13 other fellowships I could qualify for. I don't identify in this meeting, in any meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, as to call attention to my issues with macaroni and cheese that still exists today. But I will say at this point in my life, all of my other solutions start to bloom. And I am grabbing for everything I can on the outside to fix what's wrong on the inside. You know, it starts with booze and some funny cigarettes on the weekend, and it becomes pills during the week, and then I find boys, and that's like a brush fire. And then I realize that I'm drawing more attention to myself with boys if I'm losing weight, so that starts a whole food I got all sorts of food issues. And then I'm losing weight and I got to buy new clothes, so I'm stealing money from my mom and I'm writing bad checks. And I've got lies everywhere. I've got managed identities with everyone. I'm telling you what you want to hear, but it actually doesn't matter. You know, whatever I've told Susan doesn't match what I just told Jane. And I got to keep you separated. And it's work, you know. Like today I truly believe like my memory has gotten bad because I don't tell lies and need to remember it all the time. But I used to be good. And more than that, even if I did lie, it's like, so what? It's AA people. I mean, it's like, you know, I'm kind of, oh, well, next. I'll just own it. I'll be like, yeah, okay, well, I lied. All right. By the time I'm a junior in high school, I feel this, I'm so ashamed all the time, like this pending doom, pending insanity, impending poverty, impending celibacy, like it's all going to be over any minute. And I am just stressed and shameful, and I can't look you in the eye, and I find my next solution, and my next solution is taking a trip. And taking a trip for me was about getting out of town. It was escaping all of these feelings, like, of you catching up with me, and I was trying to get away from the boyfriend that I didn't really want. And so I did what I had to do, and I said what I had to say to become an exchange student. And I ended up in Mérida, Venezuela. And I'm in Venezuela, and I'm living with this beautiful family, and I love them, and I admired them so. They didn't have the half-brother of the cousin of the sister of the aunt that was married to the brother. You know, they didn't have any of that stuff. There was no hint of white trash in their history. So, I mean, there were these beautiful Latin, strong, you know, pillars of their community, strong members of the Catholic Church. They all went to Catholic school, all the kids did, and that's what I wanted to be. So, I mean, I told myself when I got there I was going to throw it into fifth gear, and it's my first attempt. I'm going to throw it into fifth gear, and I'm not going to drink, and I'm not going to drink, and I'm not going to drink, and I'm not going to be the town slut, and I'm not going to smoke cigarettes, and I'm not going to engage in the eating disorder, and I'm not going to be ashamed of my behavior, and I'm going to tell the truth all the time, and I'm going to have friends this time. And I'm just, you know, the gears are grinding, but I'm going to make it work, you know? I'm going to be who I know I can be, you know? And for about 4 months, I don't know Spanish, and I'm trying to learn Spanish, and I'm going to Catholic girls' school every day, and I'm trying to be the good girl, you know? But I love it when Clancy talks about the tightening of the screw in your gut, like what it feels like to have alcoholism, that restlessness, that irritability, that discontentment, without any solution in you. You know, that restlessness, I'm not settled anywhere. This isn't good enough. Like, it would be so much better if I was maybe with a different family, you know, maybe somebody like the president's family. It would be so much better if I got a different country, like maybe they didn't send me to Venezuela, they sent me to France. It would be so much better if I were better looking, if I were prettier, you know, when I'm wittier, prettier, and tittier, if I were all of those things. Irritable, you're not doing it right. Irritables, you're not doing it right. Like, I have no idea how to do it, but you're not doing it right. Like, tell me that doesn't come up in the rooms for you still. Like, it does for me, like, every other meeting. Like, you're not doing it right. Like, I have no idea what right is. I'm not God. Like, that is the foundation of my connection with my higher power. I'm not God. There is a power that exists, and I'm not him, and I have to remind myself all the time. And discontent, this isn't enough. I need more, you know? I just got some new red shoes. They need sequins. You know, I just got a new jean jacket, needs to be bedazzled. I have a higher education degree, I need that next degree. I have, you know, these three letters after my name for a professional whatever, and I need the next three letters. Whatever it is, it's not enough. I need more. So Christmas rolls around, and I've been there for 4 months, and I've barely spoke Spanish, and I barely understand the people, and we go to this party, and I got to tell you something, in this town where I was at in Venezuela, they did Christmas right. I mean, the town just shut down business-wise. You know, there are parades, Catholic symbolism, like just being marched through the streets. You know, every other corner had these big trucks with like house-sized speakers booming salsa and merengue. Everybody's dressed up. They're either in like religious wear or in kind of like these satin dresses with the clicky heels and the black hair and the eyelashes and the men with the little European suits. And like there's smoke filling the, you know, and confetti eggs. And it's just this amazing scene. And we get to the governor's mansion, and it was just like, it was so regal. I mean, with the black tie affair, and it was just an amazing party. And I'm just kind of like this token dish rag white girl in the corner. And I'm not eating, I'm not drinking, I'm not talking, I'm not smoking, I'm not doing any of these things. And there is no spirit in me. Someone comes by and they hand me a drink, and it's a rum and coke. You don't find yourself getting offered rum and cokes at high school parties where I'm from. So it just kind of like was a horse of a different color, and I didn't quite think of it as the horse that was the problem. And I had that mental blank spot, you know, it was like, wouldn't a shot of whiskey be nice in my milk, you know? And I took a drink, and it was like my head fired, and it just started screaming at me. You know, I can only have one drink. You can only have one drink. If you're going to drink, you know, I knew it was bad, but I couldn't quite convince myself to put the drink down, you know? Just one drink. You're only going to have one drink. You're not, all the consequences of what a drink meant. And I love it when my friend Bob in Las Vegas says, when you're promising yourself at the beginning one drink to only have one drink, it's like you're entering into a contract with yourself. And so by the time you get to the end of the drink, the person that you were under the contract with is no longer present, so the contract's null and void. It's okay to move on to the next drink. So I'm 2-3 drinks in, and I'm practicing Spanish for the first time. And they're laughing at me, but not in a hurtful way. Like, they're having fun. Like, and I got to think for a minute, they're feeling relieved that I'm talking at all, because I've just been this miserable human that didn't talk, that sat in their house, you know, and for the first time I'm trying to engage them, I'm interested, and alcohol is doing for me what it always did, which was made this two-dimensional person in front of me that it was only there for my needs, for my wants, for my service. It hydrates you, it makes you three-dimensional, it makes you another person, and I need to know about you. And then before you know it, like, I'm 5-6 drinks in, and there's men whirling me around the dance floor, and we're just salsa and merengue, and I'm just kind of like, and I think I know what I'm doing, and maybe I was meant to be Latin, and I wish I could count the number of times in my life that I had gotten somewhere and thought, with this certain group of people, when I'm finally, like, engaging them, maybe this is it. Maybe this is where I fit. Maybe this is where I'm right, you know? It's that one moment, for that one moment in time. And then I told myself the next morning, you had a great time, you know, just drink through the holiday season. And when you go back to Catholic girls' school in January, you're going to, you know, throw it into fifth gear and sit up straight and fly right and cross the T's and dot the I's and not drink and not drink and not drink. January 4th comes, and it's like that in the chapter 4, We Agnostics, there's one paragraph at the very top, and it says, if you cannot control your drinking, or if you cannot stop when you want, you might be alcoholic. And those are really the only two questions that matter to me. I love the 20 questions, but those two have me. That was my experience right there. I couldn't stop when I wanted on January 4th when I had to go back to school. I went to put on my Catholic schoolgirl uniform, and in the three-week period where I had gone back out drinking, I had managed to put on 40 pounds. Couldn't zip it. The shame of it brought me too much horror that I was even, I wasn't even capable of expressing it. And I threw the skirt off, I put some sweats on, I went and met the boyfriend that I'd acquired in the last 3 weeks from the wrong side of tracks, who was 11 years older than me, and we proceeded to break every rule of my exchange program. And within a couple months, the family that I'm living with is concerned, and they're coming at me with words like, you know, because I'm a bad example to their daughters, you know, and I'm making a bad name for their family, and it's like, cochina, mujer dañada, sucia, all these. And I'm like Teflon, you know, you're coming at me, about me, about my behavior, instantly I know you're the problem, you know. When I don't want to be separated from my alcohol, you're the problem. And I'm just telling myself, that, you know, they're just not sophisticated enough, they're a little bit too third world, they don't understand me, you know. And I didn't just do that once. I did that through Venezuela, San Diego, Denver, I met a guy, big smile. He was Cuban. He was living in New York. He was only there in training, you know, and I just thought, New York, that'll fix it, you know. And I throw all my stuff in 6 garbage bags, and I head to New York, and I follow him. I was going to make New York work, and I didn't tell him I was going to follow him. And shut up, you've done it. Then I moved to Miami, then I moved to Frankfurt, then I moved to Victorville, and then I moved to Pomona. And each time I'm there a couple years, and I'm not keeping the friends that I've made in one area and taking them to the next because they can't meet the new people, they're going to taint the well. I can't have the behaviors they thought they saw in one place follow me to the next. I get to Pomona. I just finished my degree in computer science. I white-knuckled it through. I'm maybe 350 pounds. I have pink fuchsia, red hair kind of a thing, dyed, thinking I was tough. And my face at any given time is the same color as my hair because I am in chest-crushing rage at all times. Like, I am so angry and so uncomfortable just walking around without a drink. And I remember at one point I was driving around. It was kind of my moment, and I was making a lot of money working. My degree's in computer science, and they were just throwing. It was a dot-com boom. Like with Bill, it was the Industrial Revolution. For me, it was a computer revolution. And they were throwing way too much money, and I had a 12-pack of beer on my passenger seat. And I just looked over, and I thought, you know what? I'm not going to try to stop anymore. Alcohol works. And within a year and a half, I was at the place where I was, you know, I was going on 4 or 5 day binges. I'd find myself in the hospital in a banana bag, and then either I would try to stop, you know, I'd get out after I got out of the hospital, and I'd find myself like cleaning every nook and cranny of my house, applying for resumes, picking up all my dry cleaning, $300 worth or whatever that I picked for 5 months. I'm paying off all my parking tickets, which really just the cost of parking at the end of my drinking. I'm doing whatever I have to do to get my life perfect. I'm buying $600 worth of vegetables because now I'm going to be healthy. I'm exercising every day I can, and I'm just like, let's make it work, you know, and I'd go about 3 days, and then a friend would show up, and they'd be like, let's go for a drink, and it would start all over again. And, you know, and by 5 days, I mean, I can't. Why not drink at 4 in the morning, you know? And I called a cab because it was my method of controlling and enjoying my drinking, and the cab driver was acting on his primary purpose with 18 years sober and took me to my first meeting of AA. And I got there, and it was this tiny little room in this tiny little Alano Club in Rancho Cucamonga, and I was in love with you from the minute I met you. But at the same time, it's like I look on the wall, I see the steps, I see the word alcohol once, I see the word God 7,000 times, and it took me a minute. It took me a minute to get willing to even look at that. I stood around here, and you told me my misery would be refunded if I didn't, you know, and I couldn't catch the steps by osmosis. But there was a period where I was just going to lots of speaker meetings, and I couldn't believe that this place existed. I just didn't know there were other people that felt like I did. And that's what we have to listen for here. We always have to listen for, yes, that happened to me. Yes, I felt that way. Maybe this program can work for me too. If you don't hear that tonight, newcomer, please go somewhere else. You're going to find your people. That has always been my experience, that you will find your people if you go to enough meetings. And I've just fallen in love with this place. I was maybe 90 days into it, and I showed up to my very first potluck. And I had not cooked for this one. And there were these two women. They were both about 40 years sober. Thin, very regal, sort of sophisticated-looking ladies. And they were sitting really close next to each other while their husbands were off talking or something in the corner. And they were kind of curled up and holding each other's hands and just whispering in each other's ear. One of them looks over at me, and she goes, "You, honey." And she was asking me my name and how much time I had. And I'm like, "Wendy, 60 days. And she goes, "Honey, you better keep coming back or we're going to talk about you." And I don't know what it is about you that makes me love you so much for that, you know? You know me. You know me in a way no one else could know me. I'm about a year sober, and somebody does this horrible thing to me. I'm in my home group, and I have a huge home group. You know, there's 200 people in my home group. And I'm in my home group, and it's election time. We rotate secretaries every 6 months, and somebody says, "Oh, I nominate Wendy." And, like, I don't know if you've ever been in, like, a big group, you know, election. Like, five people will get nominated, and you have to go stand outside, and, like, they vote. The most horrible thing we do to people here. And so they're voting on who's going to be the secretary, and I'm outside, and it felt like I couldn't feel my body. Like, I was, like, being voted on, you know. So I come back in, and I heard the secretary, like, you know how it is, you separate from the pain in your life, and you're just kind of moving, and the secretary says, "And my name's Wendy, by the way," she's like, "and Lindsay gets it," and I'm walking just like, I can't feel myself, and as I'm walking by, this old-timer, Jim, grabs me in my home group, he grabs my hand, and he looks up at me, and he goes, "Wendy, it was just by one vote." And I'm like, okay, I can do that, right? I mean, you know, there's a lot of people here in AA. It's not all about me, after all. I am a humble and generous human being. And I can see where someone else might need to be secretary, and I'm just kind of walking myself through it. fast forward, I would say maybe a year and a half. It was maybe about three elections. Same thing. Another election. Four or five people get nominated. One guy who has never been to the meeting before. A woman raises her hand. She's like, I nominate Bill. He's never been there before. And so he gets nominated. I'm like, man, why do we do that? So they're all outside. The only person that votes for Bill during the election is the woman that nominated him. No one else votes for him. I see Bill walk back in, and I'm sitting right behind Jim, you know? Jim grabs his hand and says, but just one vote. Alcoholics Anonymous has always done that for me. I don't know why. I don't know if you tell me the truth. I love you more today than the day I got here, and I don't walk with shame today. I know I'm a child of God. I have an integrity-filled life. I have the love of a very sweet puppy. And, you know, I own my own house. I own my own car. I have a dream job. My life is really, really good today, and you guys make it fun. I walk with hope. I walk with hope. I walk with humor and a lightheartedness. And newcomer, please hang on until you get there. Thanks.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the podcast. Sobercast is ad-free, and we'd like your help in order to keep it that way. So if you'd like to help us be self-supporting by pledging $1 or $2 a month, visit Sobercast.com and look for the donate links. Thank you very much.